responsibility for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week we'll discuss issues at the Social Security Administration and President Obama's 2014 budget proposal with AFGE National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals President Witold Skwierczynski, National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare President and CEO Max Richman, and AFGE Public Policy Director Jackie Simon. Up first, Witold Skwierczynski. Witold, welcome back.
Thanks for inviting me.
Witold, you are currently in negotiations with SSA management to address a few unresolved articles from the most recent contract agreement. I understand they're focused on appraisals, merit promotions, and working from home. Let's start off with the appraisal issue. What's happening there?
Well, just for background, we reached an agreement on our contract in August, and we set aside a few contentious articles and implemented the rest of the contract, and any agreements that we reach on the contentious articles will be incorporated into the contract and be made part of it. So we're in the process now of dealing with these contentious articles. So the appraisal article, currently the agency has a three-tier appraisal system, and we've done surveys of employees, and that was one of the top 10 issues, pre-contract surveys that employees wanted addressed. And we're having continual, you know, complaints by employees to union officials about the current appraisal system. The problem with the current appraisal system is that the agency is not forthcoming on what you have to do to achieve the highest level. They claim that there's no requirement in a contract for them to inform the employees, and most managers don't. So employees are clueless on what they have to do to get the highest level. And the highest level, of course, is linked to awards. So, you know, there's a financial benefit for getting high levels in the four elements on everyone's appraisal. And without knowing what they have to do, it's very difficult for employees to plan their work or figure out, you know, what it is that needs to be done in order for them to succeed in these in these appraisal ratings. So we have language in the contract proposed that requiring the agency to clearly inform people of what they have to do to have measurement systems which are understood by the workers, and they are informed of what measurement systems will be used to evaluate their performance, and that there be ongoing dialogue with the employees about their performance in comparison to the performance standards and what they need to do in order to achieve the highest levels. And the agency is resisting us all the way on all of these proposals.
Witold, why is it that management is resisting these proposals?
Well, we're finding, you know, we have over 1,200 field offices and teleservice centers across the country in Social Security. These are facilities where employees interview the public either face-to-face or by phone. And the teleservice centers are the folks who man our 800 number. We're getting examples of, I guess, benchmarks, guidelines, expectations. They're called different things, which individual managers issue in all of these facilities, which differ from place to place, which is, we feel, as a union, wrong. I mean, we have standard jobs across the board. You know, our key jobs are claims rep, the folks who take claims from the public, service reps, they do post-entitlement work, secure Social Security numbers for people, help people on wage reports, changes of address, and that kind of thing. And we have technical experts who are, they do the harder, they process the harder claims and do mentoring work, that they should have a standard measurement system. There should be standards. There should be standard expectations, but they differ from place to place. And so the agency really doesn't even know what all their managers are telling employees with regards to what their performance is. So they feel that if they agreed to any language which would require them to do that, they wouldn't be able to do it, which we feel is mismanagement, and that this system where individual managers basically have separate appraisal requirements in every office has got to go. So that's one of our focuses of the bargaining here.
Vitold, with this issue and a couple of the others that we're going to talk about here in a minute, are you finding that management is completely opposed to the things that you're proposing, or do you get the sense that they would be willing to work with you if they felt that the proposals that you were giving they could implement?
We've narrowed some of our differences, but what I just mentioned are some fundamental differences that we have now. The reason we think there should be more uniformity in the appraisal system is because, we have a pool of money that is distributed for awards, and it's a centralized pool, and it's not fair for employees to have different rules on how they reach the highest level and get eligible for the pool of money from office to office. We also have proposed in our merit promotion article that appraisal be an entity that is scored in the merit promotion system, and the agencies agreed to that. And if you're scoring the appraisals, and there's a different appraisal system in each office, it's totally unfair when it comes to employees competing for jobs. And our areas of consideration, where we draw candidates for promotions, tend to be region-wide for most of our jobs, so that there's potentially hundreds, if not thousands, of people who might be eligible for these promotions, and you can't have a different appraisal system in each office if they're all competing for these promotions.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Vitold Skvirchinsky, the president of AFGE's National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals. Vitold, you touched on the merit promotions issue just a minute ago. Let's talk a little bit more about that and where it stands in the contract negotiations.
Yeah, we have some basic differences. A key difference is transparency. We think the system should be clear to employees, and that actions under the system, are upfront and in the open, and the agency is not interested in that. The current appraisal system, the current merit promotion system, is based on a questionnaire. Employees fill out a questionnaire when they're seeking a promotion. The questionnaire is scored, and that's the only thing that's used to determine a well-qualified list. Candidates who've been in the agency for a year and can score exactly the same as candidates who've been in the agency for 30 years. The length of experience is not a factor in the ranking of applicants for promotions. The only thing they rank is their results on a questionnaire. Anyone who's savvy and has ever taken a test can understand the kind of answers people are looking for with these kinds of questionnaires, and employees, do that. And they may not be telling the truth when they're answering the questionnaire, but a lot of managers are encouraging them to answer the questionnaire in a way that they get the highest score. So what happens is, for most of these jobs, you have almost everyone ties for the highest score. So the agency has carte blanche ability to pick up whoever they want, which is not the purpose of a scored merit promotion system. The idea is to get the best candidates for the job. In the current system, virtually all candidates are judged to be the best, which leads to abuses, we think. We've seen managers, promote younger workers. We've seen managers promote relatives of other managers. We've seen managers promote friends of other managers. So, we think this system is prone to abuse, and we think we've documented abuses. Now, we've proposed quite a different system. We've proposed that they keep the questionnaire, but we also score appraisals. We also score awards. We also score experience that candidates may have gotten within the agency make them qualified for other promotions. We also have an area which has a variety of things that can be scored, such as education, training, details, outside experience that might be related to the job that they're putting in for. And the agency's agreed to a piece of that, which is the appraisals and awards, but not the rest. And we feel that The entire package is necessary to get a better, a more honed set of candidates on a best qualified list. In addition, we have different areas of consideration. This is where the jobs are posted and candidates are eligible in certain geographic areas for the jobs. The agency has what we would term a stovepipe proposal, which basically keeps people within their components and doesn't allow for movement across component lines, which is odd because the commissioner, when she met with the union a few weeks ago, indicated that she wanted to get rid of this kind of a system where people are only spend their lives in a particular component and have difficulty moving into another job. For instance, people in the field have difficulty going into hearings and appeals or because of these lines are drawn in the merit promotion process. The commissioner said she's wanted to end that. People in headquarters here in Baltimore, which have higher graded positions, tend to be insulated from the rest of the agency because the promotions that occur in headquarters are most of them are from people who work at headquarters rather than people in the field. So that's something that she says she wants to eliminate. The union also wants to eliminate, but her negotiators seem to be in a different track. The third issue, which is a key, is, as I said, transparency. The agency's proposal would allow a selecting official, when they're looking at the best qualified list, to make contacts to a candidate's supervisors, to do research on these candidates, all of it without documentation, all of it in secret, all of it with no transparency. We feel that that leads to abuses, that people ask questions, for instance, about leave balances, and certainly women who have children tend to have less leave than men, and that tends to be a discriminatory question, and other non-related things such as, you know, are these people union officials, or are they filing grievances, or have they filed EEO complaints? We don't know what they're talking about when they're asking these questions, but lack of transparency causes us to oppose that kind of activity. So we've proposed that any communications be up front and documented, that the main form of obtaining information be by interviewing all the candidates on the best qualified list. So we have big differences in that.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next we'll continue with AFGE National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals President Witold Skierczynski.
Attention AFGE members. Are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit that allows you to buy brand name electronics, furniture, and more through easy payroll allotment. With no upfront cash or credit check required and 12 months to pay, Purchasing Power gives you a better way to buy. AFGE members receive an 8% discount over what other federal employees pay. Learn more at afge.org/purchasingpower.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Witold Skierczynski, the president of AFGE's National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals. Witold, in the last segment, we talked about a few outstanding articles that remain as you work through completing your contract with SSA. The last one here that we're going to talk about today involves working from home or the telework process. Talk to me about where that is right now.
Well, President Obama has encouraged work at home, that federal agencies move towards more work at home. Part of it is quality of life, savings that employees have of traveling, you know, both in time and expense of traveling to work, and also savings to the government and the footprint on office space. If people are working at home, there's less of a need for office space and equipment. So that's where the president's coming from. And there have been, you know, he's signed executive orders about working at home. There's been legislation passed regarding working at home. SSA has very few people that work at home. And the reason is the previous commissioner, was reluctant to allow and refused to allow employees to have access to the beneficiary database. So since what we do is process retirement survivors and disability claims and adjudicate those claims and also engage in appeals of decisions on those claims, that's the bulk of our work. There's very few people, you know, like staff positions, some staff positions mainly, or jobs, groups of employees that we don't represent, like judges and attorneys who can download something from the system onto a disk, take it home, and not have access to the whole beneficiary record just for particular things that they're working on. So there's not that many people who do that kind of work. So those are the only ones currently eligible for work at home. So we're interested in expanding that and allowing access to the beneficiary database, which would allow a lot more people to work at home. And we think that certainly people who process claims of work that doesn't need contact with the public could certainly do that work at home. We think even that employees who do communicate with the public and certainly communicate by phone with the public at home. So we think that there's a lot of room for the agency to move. And other agencies like the VA, Department of Labor, OPM, all of which have employees who work at home and have access to their databases without having had any large problems in that area, that the fears of the agency about work at home are misplaced. And unfortunately, the agency hasn't yet agreed to allow that access. So that's a big barrier to expanded work at home. The other problem we have with their proposals is even those people who are eligible for working at home, the agency's current proposals on the table would state that management has virtually complete decision-making authority on how many days they work, when they can work, who can work, and we think that there needs to be a lot more our contract language which delves into those situations so that employees have more rights in that area and it's not a unilateral process.
Do you think at some point that you'll be able to find common ground with management, especially because in this instance with working from home, the benefits to the agency are that people can move the business of the agency forward under almost any circumstances?
Yeah, although we haven't seen it in their written proposals, in recent discussions with them, they seem to be moving towards acceptance of pilots on some of these for some people anyway who currently can't work at home, and we are interested in that. So we're having actually just scheduled a couple of days of bargaining next week. We haven't cut off negotiations. We're still bargaining. So you know, of the three disputed articles, I think work at home probably is more likely to find some common ground than the other two.
Vitold, let's shift gears for a minute. The last time that we had you on the program, we discussed outgoing Commissioner Michael Astru, who has now been replaced or ended his term, and he's been replaced by Acting Commissioner Carolyn Colvin, someone that you had endorsed previously. Talk to me about how things are going so far.
Well, I had a meeting of our executive committee of the union of the field operations union that I represent in San Antonio a few weeks ago. We invited the commissioner to be there. She couldn't, but she did appear on video conference for over an hour, and we appreciate that she did. And our union leaders had a, you know, frank, open dialogue with her, which is something we never had with the previous commissioner, who cut off all dialogue with the union after his first year in office. So we appreciate the ability to have a communication mechanism with the commissioner. Our folks liked a lot of the things she had to say about opening up the merit promotion process, about readjusting the goals of the agency to deal with realities of reduced staff and increased work, so that to relieve some of the stress on employees who have difficulty meeting unrealistic expectations that are based on higher staffing levels and lower work claims receipts. So that was a pleasant surprise. We found her open to some of ideas that we gave her during this meeting. So, you know, all that was surprising. The problem is her staff, as I mentioned before, especially in her contract negotiators, seem to have missed the bulletin board. They're not exactly absorbing what the commissioner's saying, and that's a disconnect. She is still pretty new, and it will take a while, I think, for the agency to shift gears a little, and I see it shifting gears. She's very concerned about the recent survey results. OPM does yearly surveys of employees, and SSA scored very low. People are very upset with the merit promotion system, with the lack of leadership in the agency, with the budget cuts and the stress levels within the agency, and she wants to. She's invited us to participate in seeking solutions to that under an admitted tough budget environment. She has frozen for the moment any more office closings until the agency can come up with a strategic plan, and we're happy about that. She isn't interested at this point in changing the focus on shifting work to the internet, which we're not happy about, but we didn't expect, to be in 100% agreement on all issues. So far, she's certainly an improvement from her predecessor, who, by the way, is running around cable TV news shows, being a lot more vocal about problems with the agencies and solutions. We wish he had done that when he was here. We thought he was pretty silent and allowed staff cuts and budget cuts to happen without much of a fight.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Witold Skvirchinski, president of AFGE's National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals. Witold, President Obama did release his 2014 budget proposal this week. Included in that is a calculation using chained CPI, the Consumer Price Index. What will that mean for Social Security benefits as well as the workers, Witold?
Well, that will affect not only Social Security beneficiaries, but it will affect federal employees on their federal pension. It will affect VA pensions, too, because they're all tied to the Consumer Price Index. And what I guess the president is proposing is that they use what's called a chain CPI, which assumes that if prices go up on certain elements of the Consumer Price Index, people will go seek other products or do different things. So an example, I guess, would be if the price of beef goes up, people might switch to chicken. Unfortunately, seniors, studies have shown that some of the higher end elements of the Consumer Price Index, such as medical treatment, are higher used by seniors and disabled people, so that kind of chain CPI doesn't work for them. In fact, a lot of people have suggested an elderly CPI, which would provide a higher cost of living than the Consumer Price Index. So the effect is cumulative. It's, I think, a 0.3% reduction in a benefit if you use the chain CPI. After 20 years, though, that becomes a 6.5% cut, and we're talking $1,100, $1,200 if you're looking at a year. And if you're looking at it over a period of time, on the average Social Security benefit, by 65, folks, beneficiaries will have lost $4,600. By 85, they would have lost $13,900. And by 95, they would have lost $28,000. So the chain CPI is a benefit cut, and it shouldn't be characterized as anything but a benefit cut. For disabled people who are in benefits for longer periods of time, the cuts are pretty drastic in time. Now, we, of course, oppose the chain CPI approach. We don't think Social Security has had anything to do with the current deficits that exist in this country. In fact, Social Security FICA taxes have run, plus interest gained on borrowed Social Security money, are still in surplus and have been used to finance the country's debt. So, rather than creating the debt, Social Security taxes have been instrumental in reducing the debt. So it's not that's not the problem. And to say that elderly, disabled people veteran pensioners or federal government pensioners should be punished with benefit cuts because of budget deficits that they didn't create and because of the reluctance to properly tax wealthy people is ridiculous. And so this, you know, we're asking our members and their families to oppose the change CPI. Another thing that we really have a problem with and that appears to be happening in the Obama budget is a tax increase on federal employees. Now, why federal employees should get a tax increase as opposed to the wealthy is beyond my belief. The tax increase would be a 1.2%, it appears, increase in the contribution that all federal employees would make for their pension benefits without any consequent increase at all in the benefit. So that's a tax increase. We'd have to pay 1.2% more, a 1.2% tax only for federal employees. No one else would pay this tax but federal employees in an effort to save government money. That would be, I believe, the government would this is speculation since I haven't seen the budget yet, but that the government would reduce its contribution by 1.2% and therefore save tax dollars. Now the federal employees have already contributed in the fiscal cliff settlement. We have contributed in with about $112 billion in cuts because of pay freezes that we've had for 3 years. And because of new employees this year having to pay a higher percentage of their pension contributions. So we thought that after contributing $112 billion that federal employees had already paid at the bank and that other parts of society would have to pay their fair share if you want cuts in budget deficits. But it appears President Obama wants to go after federal employees again.
Witold Skvirchinsky, the president of AFGE's National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals. Witold, always fun talking to you. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Jason. Always a pleasure.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll be joined by a National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare President and CEO, Max Richmond.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. To see how much you could save, call the AFGE Benefits Hotline at 1-888-844-2343 to get the members-only phone number from MetLife. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, WFED.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. Joined now by Max Richmond, the president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Max, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jason. Thank you for inviting me again.
Max, the president, as we had mentioned earlier in our program, has included in his fiscal 2014 budget proposal the chained CPI cost of living formula. What is your analysis of this?
Well, it's pretty straightforward if you want to be honest about it. It is a reduction in Social Security benefits that starts out small and grows over time. As you know, the cost of living adjustment is all every year is built into the base, and so it's compounded, and it grows dramatically over time. Starts out small, but you can appreciate the magnitude of the reduction if you look at how much money this budget would save by making this change in the formula for the COLA. It's $127 billion. And where's that money coming from? It's coming out of the pockets of Social Security beneficiaries. So it is a big deal.
$127 billion over 10 years certainly sounds significant, Max. What do you think the impact is going to be on the standard of living of people depending on Social Security?
Well, you know, what's really troubling about this initiative is the current formula is flawed. The current formula that is used has been used since the mid-70s to compute the cost of living adjustment. The way inflation has been measured is flawed because it does not take into account adequately and put the proper weight on the goods and services that seniors rely on. It is a measure of inflation as it affects wage earners. So the current formula is flawed. If you ask seniors whether the average COLA over the last 4 years, they got the average for 4 years was 1.3%, and two of those years they got zero. And if you ask them, is this too generous? Well, you can imagine their response. So the current formula is flawed. The new formula that is being talked about, the chain CPI, is even stingier. It would reduce the COLA. And as I said, that reduction grows over time.
Max, if I'm not mistaken, there's also about $24 billion coming from VA benefits as well as civilian and military retirement pay cuts. Is that right?
Absolutely. It's Social Security beneficiaries, veterans benefits, federal, civilian and military retirees. So this will have broad impact on these beneficiaries and also, obviously, on the economy. People will have less money. They'll have less money to spend to fuel the economy. This is really a misguided proposal. I don't understand the thinking behind it, but what I do know is it will not be possible, in my opinion, to sell this to seniors, veterans, federal and civil and military retirees as a minor technical adjustment. They're not going to buy it because they know that the current cost of living that they're experiencing, the increase, exceeds what the COLA has been providing them, and a smaller COLA will be even worse. So it's not a technical adjustment. It's not being done for the sake, I think, of accuracy. It's being done to put Social Security out there as a bargaining chip in negotiating for a grand deal. If the administration was serious about finding a accurate measure of inflation, they only have to look to the Consumer Price Index E, which is for the elderly. It's an experimental formula that has been in place for about 20 years or more, has never been applied, and has never been thoroughly developed. But it should be thoroughly developed, and it would provide a slightly higher COLA because it measures those things that seniors rely on and that they buy. So rather than pursuing a more accurate measure of inflation, the administration has taken the approach of finding a way to save money, to use Social Security, as I said, in negotiations with the Republicans for a grand bargain on our deficit and debt.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Max Richmond, the president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. So then, Max, my question for you is, what are the next steps here? What has to happen next?
Well, yesterday, the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, and our coalition partners, AFL, Now, MoveOn.org, and many others, Campaign for America's Future, we held a rally in front of the White House, and we delivered over 2 million petitions that these various groups had collected in the last few months, objecting to these cuts in Social Security. And we presented them to the White House. We had a U.S. senator and a number of House members speak. I spoke. And we need to continue on this course. This was just the first step, the rally and the petition delivery. We are having today, on Wednesday, a call-in Congress Day, and the number is 1-800-998-0180, and we plan to flood the switchboards with calls from around the country, and this number has been posted on our website and many other websites. I think when members of Congress start hearing, not just from lobbyists like me, but from their constituents who vote, they'll take a second look at this reduction in Social Security benefits. And I do believe that any politician that believes that seniors will not notice this reduction and will simply view it as a an adjustment made for for the sake of accuracy, any politician that is of that opinion is going to have a rude awakening next November, because seniors, as I'm sure you know, they follow this. They are very aware of what the COLA is every fall, because it's so important in their planning, really for surviving for the next year. So it's something that is near and dear to the hearts of veterans, Social Security beneficiaries, and military and civilian federal retirees. So I think this, as I said, this was the first step yesterday, we have experience as a national organization in defeating a bad proposal by a recently reelected president. We did it when George W. Bush came out of the box after the 2004 election and wanted to use his capital to privatize Social Security. He couldn't even convince his own party to push that in the Congress. And so there is a formula for fighting this, and we're going to pursue that in every possible way.
Max, as we close out here, can you give me a quick snapshot of what these programs mean, Social Security, Medicare, and the like, what they mean for average middle-class Americans?
Well, you know, the average Social Security check is a little over $1,200 a month. Almost 40% of Social Security beneficiaries rely on that check, and that's the average. Some are $500, $600, $700 a month, but almost 40% of beneficiaries rely on Social Security for at least 90% of their income. And I think it's important for members of Congress to become aware of that political reality, that is barely enough. Maybe not enough, but barely enough to survive. And making further reductions, especially as seniors get older and have fewer resources, that is not going to be acceptable, not just by seniors, but all the polling we've seen, all of it shows that there is very little support for cutting Social Security to address our deficit and our national debt. And I'm talking about Democrats, Republicans, Independents, old, middle-aged, young. This is not what the American people want. And I think there's a big disconnect between what the American people want and what the president has advocated here, and a disconnect between what the president has promised in his campaigns. He said he would not cut the cost of living adjustment. At a private meeting that I attended at the White House 1 week after his reelection, he agreed with me that Social Security should not be part of these negotiations on the debt. And in his inaugural address, I remember the comments because I thought it was so eloquent. He said the commitments we make to each other through Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid do not sap our initiative. They strengthen us.
Max Richman, the president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Max, great to have you back on the program today. Thanks for joining
us. Anytime. I appreciate the invitation.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll get an update on the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program with AFGE Public Policy Director Jackie Simon.
Attention AFGE members. Are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit that allows you to buy brand name electronics, furniture, and more through easy payroll allotment. With no upfront cash or credit check required and 12 months to pay, Purchasing Power gives you a better way to buy. AFGE members receive an 8% discount over what other federal employees pay. Learn more at afge.org/purchasingpower.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Jackie Simon, AFGE's Public Policy Director. Jackie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Jackie, you testified this week before a House Oversight and Government Reform Subcommittee about the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program. What was the focus of your testimony?
Well, OPM has a package of changes they'd like to see enacted. And the hearing was to discuss each of these proposals and what their likely impact would be on the program, on enrollees, on costs.
Let's talk about some of these proposed changes to the program. First and foremost, you discussed discounts for wellness. Talk to me about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, it sounds nice, discounts for wellness. But the flip side, of course, is to charge more for people who have the misfortune of having an illness or having some kind of physical condition over which they have no control and consequently being charged more than their coworker. And we really look at health insurance as a form of compensation. We wouldn't pay lower salaries to people who happen to be ill for doing the same job. And providing, you know, less of an employer subsidy for health insurance is no different from a lower salary. And one of the things, of course, they're really talking about is obesity. More and more medical research has shown that obesity is as much a function of genetics as height. Although we all know that we should eat a healthy diet and exercise and all that kind of thing, whether or not we are obese is almost apart from what we eat and how much we exercise. And I don't say that. It's not true across the board, but it's true for some people. And there's no reason they should receive lower compensation from their employer just because of a genetic condition.
There was also talk about adding a new premium tier called the Self Plus One. What can you tell me about that?
Well, it's very frustrating. I can only tell you a little. For years and years, OPM's actuaries maintained that Self Plus One would be more expensive than family coverage. Now, OPM says that government would save quite a bit of money by implementing a Self Plus One, but one of the most frustrating things is that OPM has refused to provide us any kind of information about what kind of models their actuaries use to come up with their estimates of the impact of Self Plus One. So the short answer is that we have absolutely no idea what it would do to premiums, what it would do if people migrated out of family coverage into Self Plus One, or would they go to a completely different plan. It would have multiple consequences for the program. And, OPM's favorite line is there'll be winners and losers. Well, we want to know who's winning, who's losing, how much are they winning by, how much are the losers losing by, what's the overall cost, and what would be the impact on premiums for family and for Self Plus One. We haven't had any of those questions answered.
You mentioned that OPM was not very forthcoming with some information. Why is that?
It's truly bizarre, and all I can do is speculate about the motivations of some of the people who are working over at OPM. It's ironic. There was more transparency and more access in the George W. Bush administration than there's been in this administration at OPM, that is. And I hasten to add, only in the area of health care. Obviously, the other staff at OPM are great, and they're always very helpful and open and provide information on retirement and pay and things like that, but not on health insurance. Very secretive, and it's very frustrating. That's why we also call in our testimony for the establishment of an employee advisory council on FEHBP, similar to what we have on the Thrift Savings Plan, on white and blue-collar pay, where we have by law the right to sit down with OPM and receive information and have input into the administration of the program.
One of the other things that you mentioned in your testimony were the regional PPO's proposal. Tell me about those.
Well, that's another proposal about which OPM refuses to provide any information. Their target really is Blue Cross Blue Shield. What they want to do is eliminate the national plan because, of course, Blue Cross Blue Shield has a national plan for the federal government, but there's also a Blue Cross Blue Shield organization in every state. And the national plan wouldn't compete with these regional PPOs. And there's a big question about whether or not, you know, what would be the benefit of a regional PPO? It'd be smaller than Blue Cross Blue Shield national, so it would have less market power and have less ability to control prices. We're not sure at all that it would be a better deal. But again, it's one of those winners and losers kind of things. I think, in theory, prices might be cheaper in a couple of states and much, much higher in other states. And, you know, we'd be open to hearing more about it if OPM would provide some information that they may have or may not. I'm told they do have. They just won't provide it. That would tell us, you know, who would be the losers, who would be the winners. You can't really take a position in favor of something like that without information about what its impact would be. And having no information in our testimony, we oppose that change.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Jackie Simon, AFGE's Public Policy Director. Jackie, how much of the total premiums do federal employees and retirees pay?
Well, it varies, but on average, you know, in the aggregate for the whole program, employees pay about 30% of premiums.
30%. So why is it then that they don't have more say collectively in the decisions that are made related to their health care?
Good question. That's the question we asked the subcommittee, and that's the question we're going to be asking all lawmakers to answer with the establishment of an advisory committee so we can have some formal input.
Another issue that's getting a lot of attention is the coverage of the applied behavioral analysis therapy for autism. Talk about why this is so important to federal employees.
Well, I believe 37 states right now, and counting because there are more all the time, mandate coverage for ABA for children with severe autism. You know, obviously not everybody on the autism spectrum requires this form of treatment, but those who do require it, it's life-saving, it's life-altering, it's widely recognized as the most effective therapy, and it's crucial that it be available to these children when they're very young. And FEHBP, OPM has for years, I've been working on this issue for years and years, they've said, oh, it's a form of education, it's occupational therapy, it's not health care. You know, when 37 states recognize it as health care, the federal government just sort of stands alone and looks foolish. This is, you know, really almost, it's not life and death in the sense of cancer treatment or no cancer treatment, but it's so, so life-altering for people who receive this kind of therapy. It can really make the difference between having any kind of ability to function independently or being dependent all your life. So it's ultimately it's cost effective for the government, and it's certainly the humane thing to do. John Barry, on his, you know, and his better moments, recognized that this was desirable, and he was very proud of the fact that he made it optional in OPM rather than prohibiting it. But very, very few plans responded to the option. And Blue Cross Blue Shield, of course, the big one, covers 62% of all enrollees, does not provide coverage. So we want it mandated.
Where does OPM stand on domestic partner benefits in the program?
Their initiative is to allow coverage for domestic partners of either same-sex or opposite-sex couples and their dependents. And, of course, because of DOMA, there's still tax implications for dependents who don't meet the IRS definition of an economic dependent. So it's still not equal. And although we, you know, support the baby step that OPM is proposing, what we want, of course, is full equality for all federal employees, heterosexual, gay, lesbian, and their families.
How does the Affordable Care Act, or of course Obamacare, factor into all of this?
The biggest thing that we talked about in the testimony is the fact that in 2018, there's this time bomb tax increase that will be passed on to federal employees because federal employee health insurance benefits are very, very expensive. And they're not expensive because they're Cadillac plans and have really rich benefits. They're expensive because of structural flaws in the system. And in spite of the fact that this is a tax supposedly meant to penalize employers or for providing Cadillac plans, what it's really going to do is penalize federal employees because FEHBP is such a poorly run and poorly structured plan.
Jackie, this week President Obama released his fiscal 2014 budget proposal, which included about $35 billion in reforms to the federal retirement programs. Talk to me about this situation and what it actually means for federal employees.
Yeah, I was with President Cox when we got that news, and we were all dumbfounded. We were certainly not just led to believe, told quite explicitly that when Congress enacted and the president signed into law the enormous increase in retirement costs for employees hired after January 1st, 2013, that would be it. That would satisfy Obama's and the Republicans' demand that federal employees pay more for their retirement benefits. So federal employees hired after January 1st, 2013 are going to pay 3.1% of their salaries. It's a 2.3% salary cut forever, supposedly, to respond to a temporary deficit. And now he comes back with another $35 billion in cuts. It's utterly outrageous. It's a total betrayal. It's totally reneging on every understanding that we had made our sacrifice and then some to the federal budget. And this, after 3 years of pay freeze and furloughs from sequestration, it's just such an outrage. We will fight this with everything we've got. I mean, people are angry. They're not disappointed. They're not sad. They're quite angry at this betrayal.
And these are items that are starting to add up. Salary freezes, sequestration, furloughs, increased pension contributions. There's a lot here, totaling, of course, over $100 billion already. What's the outlook on this?
I can't speculate as to when or if it will ever stop, but the only thing standing between this and dramatically lower living standards for federal employees is the effort of AFGE and its members. I know I'll do everything I can. I know our elected leaders will do everything we can, and we just have to try to motivate our members to mobilize against this and really, really let the Congress know that this is utterly unacceptable. You know, Obama may continue in his favorite activity of trying to appease his enemies by going after us. Not that it ever works, but somehow we still get the cuts. But we need to fight this.
And I think it's important to note, and something that you and I have talked about on this program, is that the federal employees that we're talking about here are middle-class Americans.
Absolutely. It was rather galling yesterday to hear that President Obama had said that he promised to protect the middle class in his so-called balanced approach. Well, his balanced approach takes $35 billion out of the pockets of middle class federal employees and their families. And we haven't mentioned the CPI change for Social Security, which will take money out of middle class pockets of people who receive veterans benefits, who've been injured in the course of defending their country through the military, people on disability, retirees in Social Security, and federal retirees. So how dare he present himself as a protector of the middle class when he is simultaneously supporting this outrageous cut in benefits? It's just, well, you can hear the anger in my voice.
Do you imagine a scenario where AFGE will be able to sit down with the administration at some point and perhaps address these issues directly?
I think we will certainly try to do that, and I know that our lobbyists are already on Capitol Hill talking to lawmakers, urging them to reject this budget just in its entirety.
Jackie Simon, AFGE Public Policy Director. Jackie, great having you on the program. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you to our guests this week, AFGE National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals President Witold Skvirchinski, National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare President and CEO Max Richman, and AFGE Public Policy Director Jackie Simon. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife.
WFED Washington.